This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
It's a concession. If already you've got to the level where you've reached the zenith and you've been able to survive there for 30 days, to come back from there to the ordinary levels of ordinary human beings, that's not a nice thing, and it needs kapara, one needs atonement, and he has to bring a korban chatos. That's what the Ramban says. Rabbi Eli Bechaya attacks the Ramban because he says that still it doesn't really help the difficulty in understanding this korban, because we never find a korban which is brought prior to the sin. You can't bring a korban and then do the sin tomorrow. So look, tomorrow I plan to do a nice chet aveira, so I'll bring my korban chatos today, and I can enjoy myself tomorrow. The korban chatos is, well, we don't have such a thing. The korban chatos is only after the sin, and it's only if the sin is done by mistake. And here we see that even before he comes down, he has to bring the korban. Furthermore, it's very difficult because the Ramban's question is asked by the Gemara. The Gemara itself asks the question. Of course it's difficult to understand what the reason for the korban is. And in mind the Gemara, it's a brisa. In Gemara Tainis Staff Yudalef, Rabbi Elozer Hekper, Berebi Omer, Ma Talmud Loima V'chiper Olov Ma'asher Choto Al HaNefesh. What does it mean when it says in our parsha, when he brings the korban, that he brings the korban in order to atone for the sinning soul? What terrible avera did this man do that he has to bring a korban chatos? Asks Rabbi Elozer Hekper. He answers, Elo shetzir atzmoy min hayayin. For a whole month, he caused himself suffering by not drinking wine. There's a difference between not drinking wine because you don't feel like wine, and not drinking wine because you're prohibited upon yourself. You all know that one can often go a whole day without eating or drinking anything, and it doesn't bother one. One's busy, one's got other things on one's mind. Comes the fast day, and half an hour after breakfast time, one's already feeling the pangs of hunger. It's a tsar. Once you've forbidden something, there's a tsar involved. And Rabbi Elozer Hekper makes a kal vachomer from this. This person who only deprived himself of wine, of nothing else, only wine, all the other pleasures of the world he indulges in, and he's called a sinner. And the Tzayr, that's when we call Dover the Dover, a person who deprives himself of other things which the Torah permits. Allah has come of a kama, how much more so? Self-deprivation, says Rabbi Elozer Hekper, is no virtue. The Nazir has decided he has to do it for reasons which we'll discuss. Good, the Torah allows him to do it, but that in itself is a concession. Rabbi Elozer Hekper doesn't look too admirably upon this Nazir, although the Torah calls him a Kodesh, and we begin to see that there's a sort of a split personality in this Nazir. The Torah calls him a Kodesh, holy, and Rabbi Elozer Hekper calls him a sinner. The Torah also calls him a sinner and requires that he bring the Korban Chatos. So within the Psukim itself, we already see this ambivalent attitude to the Nazir. On the one hand, he's considered a holy man, a Kodesh LaHashem. On the other hand, he has to bring a Korban Chatos. So the Ramban has solved it a little bit. The Ramban says he has to bring the Korban because he's coming down from his levels of sanctity. In other words, the Ramban says he's bringing the Korban for becoming normal again. But while he was a Nazir, he doesn't have to have atonement for that. That was a great thing. That's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara says he's bringing the Korban for his period of Nazirus. He was wrong while he was a Nazir, or he was... can't say wrong, the Torah allows him to do it, but he was involved in an activity which the Torah does not fully approve of, self-deprivation. And Rabbi Elozer Hekper says, if you have to bring a Korban Chatos, when you do it with the permission of the Torah, and it's only one product that you're depriving yourself of, and there was good reason to deprive yourself of that product, and yet you have to bring a sacrifice, a sin offering for that, how much more so is it wrong to deprive oneself of anything else? Rabbi Elozer takes a different attitude. Nikro Kodesh, and Emma Kodesh Yeh, Gadol Perasai Rusha. The Torah calls him a Kodesh, calls him a holy person, because he doesn't cut his hair. Again, not just that he went for a month without a haircut. It means that the fact that he didn't cut his hair, that it was prohibited for him to cut his hair. This person who only deprived himself of one pleasure, that was the pleasure of cutting his hair. And we don't realize, by the way, nowadays the people walk around with long hair and with beards and things like that. We don't realize what it was. There's a Yiddish barber in the area now. Shall we say a barber of Jewish descent? In near Lubbock Avenue. He's a Litvisher, an old Litvisher barber. He learned the skills in Lithuania. He was one of those original ones that came out. He tells me he's one of the last ones left at the Veldner service from Lithuania. And he tells me that in the good old days in Lithuania, they used to come into the barbershop every morning before you went to work. You used to come and go to the barber for a shave. They didn't have electric shavers. It was a whole social thing as well. Your day used to start, for the non-frum, the day used to start mamish at the barber, and for the frum after shakris, when you finished shakris and had some breakfast, the barber was the next stop. People used to go every day, and it was a pleasure, and one used to just catch up on the news, and one used to be able to hear what's going on in the town. It was a very important thing, and this time, for 30 days, not to go into the barber shop, is quite a withdrawal from society. Both in the way one's appearance looks and one's unshaven, and also that one's not in contact. Hamatzai Ratzmei Michol Dova, a person who thinks, Al Achas Kamo V'Kamo, how much more so is he called holy? Here we have two different views, opposing views. Rabbi Elozo Hekper and Rabbi Elozo, same two people with a similar name. The one says, we learn from the Nozir how severely wrong it is to deprive oneself of anything. Because even the Nozir, who did it with the sanction of the Torah and only deprived himself of one product, still is called a chote, a sinner. And the other says, no, he's called a Kodesh. All he deprived himself of was his haircut. And for that he's called a Kodesh. How much more so a person who deprives himself of other things. So when at Ask the Rabbi evenings, people say, Rabbi, what is the Torah's view on self-deprivation and self-denial? It's not an easy question to answer. One has to take out the Gemara and learn it. There's no simple answer to it. Be that as it may, the Ramban's question is more difficult. We're asking why he brings a korban when the Gemara says very clearly why he brings a korban. He brings a korban chatos because he deprived himself of wine. That's what the Gemara says. Nobody disagrees with that. So why is the Ramban so troubled and goes to the lengths of giving a new reason, which he takes for himself? It's not from the Gemara. That he's bringing the korban chatos for his come down, not for what he did while he was a nozir. We need to learn a medrash in order to understand fully this ambivalent attitude to the nozir. The medrash says Shimon HaTzadik Omar. Shimon HaTzadik was a kohen gadol, and he said the following: Miyomai lo yochalti oshom nozir, elo ach. Throughout my experience in the office of Kahuna, I have only eaten of the korban brought by a nozir once. I used to not, I wouldn't have anything to do with those korbans. Other korbans, yes, but that korban, I wouldn't partake in. Only one did I participate in. Pam achas olo elai echod min hadorim. Once a man from the south came up to me. And I saw he was a redhead with beautiful eyes and good to look at. And his curls, on the last day of his Nazirus. That means he was going to now bring his korban, he would have to have his hair shaven off. You see, Lawrence, what happens to people with long hair? Careful there. Omarti lo, I said to him, Moru iso la ashchis es asar hanoe haze. I was a bit suspicious. What kind of unbalanced human being is this? He's got such beautiful hair. No, whether he should have such long hair or he doesn't, how he puts on tefillin, how he wears a yarmulke, that's another discussion. That is such Shimon HaTzadik. I'm interested in the mental stability of the man at the moment, not in the frumkeit of the man. The man normal. So I said to him, what did you see to cut off this beautiful hair? Namli confided in me, Rebbe, Roye ho yisi be'iri. I was a shepherd in my city. The first part of this medrash is brought several places in the Gemara as well. V'holachti l'malis es haniv min hamayim. And I went to fill the container, the water container, the trough from the spring. V'ro'isi es habuv yeshili b'toich hamayim. And as I was bending over the water to fill my trough from the spring, I saw my reflection in the water. Ufochaz yitzri olai. And for a moment, I had an impulse of yetzer hara. The yetzer hara got the better of me. Uvikesh la'avdeni min ho'ilom. And it wanted to destroy me. One can imagine already what the yetzer hara was saying to him. Person with your kind of looks. So you could have any girl you wanted in the whole world. What are you doing as a young shepherd boy stuck away in this desert town in the Negev? Go to Tel Aviv to the bright lights and have a good time. No need to be stuck away in the back of the world not enjoying life. Life only comes round once. And very few people could have the opportunities that are open to you, young man. Amatiloy, I said to him, to my Yetzer Hara, Roshe, Amatiloy, I said, To myself, really, to my Yetzer Hara, but to me. Rosh, are you wicked, you wicked one? Ma atom misnoye bedoro she'ino shulcho. What are you taking such pride in something which isn't even yours? Shel ofo shel rimo v'shel toleohu. What you're admiring is really dust and it's decay and it's worms. What's going to happen to it in the end? It's nothing permanent, nothing real. I have it it's been lent to me, it's been given to me for a period of time. You're not the balabot, you don't own it. Olai lahagdishcho l'shamayim u'legalechecho l'shamayim. I must undertake to dedicate my hair to heaven and to shave it off l'shem shamayim. The end of the young man's story, says Shimon HaTzadik, Vehirkanti es roshi, and I bent down my head, unishaktiv, and I kissed him, v'omarti lo, and I said to him, kamoyscho yirbu oisei ritzoyin hamokrim b'Yisroel. Such as you, there should be many more who do the will of Hashem in Yisroel. Alecho amar akosav, about you, the Torah says, lahazil laHashem, to be a nozir to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's a nozir, says Shimon HaTzadik. You see the beautiful discernment of Shimon HaTzadik. Normally one gets very impressed with the frumkeit of the nozir. Can you imagine? New chumras, and this is all within the Torah's ambit. I'm a nozir. So, would you like to have some wine? Sorry, I'm a nozir. Can't. Why are you a nozir? Kodesh, I'm in sanctity, and I've dedicated myself for the month. Can you imagine how many nazirim Shimon HaTzadik came across in his day? And he was so unimpressed with every one of them that he wouldn't eat of their korban. This young man, a simple shepherd boy from goodness knows where, is probably not of much background if he used to walk around with his hair like that. Who knows what kind of fellow he was. From this one, Shimon HaTzadik is willing to eat. This is something that he identifies as being, this he says, is lahaz. This is what the Torah means when it talks about a nozir. It's talking about you. That's what it means. For the first time I've seen a real nozir, says Shimon HaTzadik. Rabbi Muna boy, the Medrash isn't altogether happy with the story, and Rabbi Muna asks on the story. Sometimes the people tell Maisalach, and it's amazing, I very seldom hear when a story is being told about someone that anybody asks any questions on it. That's not because the story is always so sensible. It's because I think since childhood we've been inculcated with the sanctity of fairy tales, that one doesn't ask questions whether they're logical or they're not logical, whether they make sense or they don't make sense, you're macabre. And so when people tell stories also, it's very seldom do we use our critical faculties, and it's very wrong. how many stories are told of the Gedolim which are wrong. Many of them I've seen printed, and I know the stories firsthand. I know how wrong they are. And people tell them and repeat them and say them over, and nobody listens and says, but it can't be. It's not possible that that's what this is. It's not Chayach. It cannot be. And Rabbi Muna asks, not prepared to accept the story on its face value. Lama lo yashim natarik oichel osham nozir. Why wouldn't he eat the osham of a nozir? Because the nozir had sinned. If it's because a nozir is a sinner, because he held himself, he deprived himself of wine, as the Gemara says, and that's why Shimon HaTzadik didn't want to have anything to do with him. If somebody by mistake ate chelev or ate dam, which is treif, and he had to bring a korban chatos afterwards, would Shimon HaTzadik not eat from that korban? He doesn't say he wouldn't. It's only the korban of the nozir that he wouldn't eat of. So it's not because it's a sin offering. He's willing to eat from sin offerings. So why is the sin offering of a nozir worse than an ordinary sin offering? Asks Rabbi Muna. Answers the Medrash. Sovar Shimon HaTzadik. B'nei Adam mitoich akpodo him noidrim b'nozir. The Medrash of amazing psychological insight. Shimon HaTzadik believed that people sometimes take on the vows of Nazirus in a moment of aggressive reaction. Even Shem Nodrim Mitech HaKpoda, and since their neder was motivated by aggression, Soifon Litohis, when the aggression dies down, they're going to regret. The Kivan Shehu Toye, and once he is regretted, Nasu Korbanosov Kashrichit Chulin Ba'azor. When he brings his korban, it's as if it's not really a korban on a valid nazirus. If a person, for example, takes on nazirus using the wrong formula or with the wrong intentions, and he comes to bring a korban, that's an issur. He's not allowed to. That means he's brought a korban, which is not really a korban. You can't come and shecht your own meat in the Beis Hamikdash. Only if it's a valid korban, and if you weren't a valid nozir, you can't bring a valid korban. So Shimon HaTzadik, when people regret their nazirus during the course of the nazirus, it detracts from the validity of the korban. So Shimon HaTzadik, I as a kohen don't want to take the risk of eating from a sacrifice which may not really be a necessary sacrifice. But this man, mitoich yishuv adas nodar, he took his neder with clarity of thought, feel the libo shovim, and his mouth and his heart are at peace with one another. His mind and his actions are integrated and congruent. We see here the concept that I mentioned earlier in the Chalashudas of self-denial as an expression of aggression. One of the areas where one sees that very clearly is in a disease such as anorexia. Partly, not typified by any means, but is partially stimulated by an anger towards the mother. And the mother's job is to feed a child, and if a child wants to show the mother, I'm going to show the whole world that you haven't got the job, I'm going to die on you. The die of starvation. See what the world says about you then. Which Jewish mother wants to hear that their child has died then because of starvation? And it's a deliberate act of aggression, of anger, usually directed against the mother. It's part of it. I said one can't attempt to oversimplify. But certainly the relationship of the mother to the daughter is a very primary area of investigation in any case of anorexia. Self-mutilation, suicide is very, very often simply an act of aggression, an act of anger taken out upon oneself. And self-denial, here we begin to see in this medrash, we already see the two attitudes, the fact that there are certain nazirim, in fact the majority of them, the Shimon HaTzadik would not eat from their korban, and from this korban he would, and he says, this is Nozir Hashem, and he kisses this young man, shows that one sees that there are two different types of nazirim. There's a nazir who's doing it properly, and there's a nazir who's not doing it properly. And there's a very serious difference between them. The one is reacting to a situation, and the other isn't. We'll examine in a moment the positive nozir. I've mentioned in several shiurim and lectures recently the effects of modern Western thinking in terms of blaming objects external to oneself for one's problems. And the inability to see one's problems and one's virtues, not only one's problems, as integrated into one's own self-being. We've given several examples of that. We've also shown how the language itself, how the English language has come to express that attitude. Whereas in the old days people used to say, I am worried. The modern expression is, I have a problem, or you have a problem. I am ill. The modern way of saying it is, you have a disease, or you'll even name the disease. Each situation you'll find, I have insomnia, I cannot sleep. Different ways of labeling things in an objective way. There's an objective thing which I have, it's like a growth, which has to be cut away, and then I'll be left okay. When you take that problem away from me, then I'll be okay. All that needs to be removed. Yeah, in this medrash we have an extension of that principle. That principle goes very, very far. It works in all sorts of it, in absolutely every area of life. The extent that you watch yourself and see how many times you blame something outside of yourself for a problem. On an international scale, we had it recently with the Challenger incident. They still say, and a newspaper article will still say, after the inquiries are finished, Challenger exploded because one of these rings of a booster rocket that was weak blew up. They didn't decide why they didn't repair it and did it, it should have been repaired, etc. But they won't say Challenger exploded because the authorities were careless and thoughtless. That they won't say. It's completely against Western civilization to see the problem within myself, and that the change of attitude needs to be developed. It doesn't help putting on new rings, because next time something else is going to blow. There needs to be a change of attitude. I am the problem. Not the rings, and not the booster rockets, and not somebody else. I am the problem. Our attitude was wrong. Our sense of the value of human life was inadequate. That's what needs. And so the answer, the solution, is not to make stronger rings. The solution is to take all the people that are involved and give them a 6-week crash course in Musar. Let them learn Musar from morning till night about the value of human life. And they'll come out of it with a different perspective. That's the solution. They're not looking at that at all. It doesn't enter the mind that the problem is an emotional, psychological, spiritual problem. It's an attitude of the civilization. You can't just change one or two people. If the whole civilization values results more than the individual, if an individual's worth is measured by his results, then of course it's more important to get 20 space shuttles up in a year than it is to make sure that those 7 astronauts come back safely. That's the way the attitude develops, and you've got to change the whole civilization. You can't just change one person. You've got to change the pressure, you've got to change the media, you've got to change the administration, you've got to change the economic system. Everything has to be changed to re-emphasize human value and de-emphasize a little bit the importance of measurable results. Because measurable results is the same thing. It's a way of saying, that's what I've achieved. Have a look. There, that's what I've achieved. I can show you. I can hang it on the wall. I can measure it. I can take a photograph of it. That's what I've achieved. We don't measure achievement like that. We've got to see achievement as, this is what I've achieved. This is what I've achieved with my life. And if you can't see it, that's your problem if you can't see it. I know what I've achieved. I've achieved my self-worth. And it's been jolly hard achieving it. That's how we have to reorientate ourselves. That's a complete change of education. It will take 50 years to do it. That's not making the rings of the rocket stronger. More and more people are going to die with this kind of attitude through faulty technology. And it works also in positive areas. Not only is one's failure blamed on external factors, but one's virtues also seen as outside things. And that's why we can have in Yiddishkeit today a situation where people are taking on Torah and not changing. It's all external things. I'm frum. Why? Who says you're frum? What do you mean, who says I'm frum? I keep Shabbos. I put on tefillin. I go to a shir. I daven every morning. I say Kriya Shema. And you list the things, the actions. But it doesn't mean that I'm frum. It doesn't mean that I've changed. It doesn't mean my value system has reorientated itself. And that doesn't worry us. As long as one is able to measure it, then it's okay. One measures how are you doing by how many black Gemara have you learnt? How many pages of Gemara have you learnt? Not how well do you know the Gemara. Not how stimulated have you become by the Gemara. Not to what extent has Gemara changed my life. That's not how we develop it. Even if Gemara hasn't changed my life at all, I've learnt 20 daf. That's what's important. Measurable. 20. Yesterday it was 19, today it's 20. So I must have progressed. You haven't progressed at all. You're the same. It's the pages which have progressed, not you. It's another page, but it's not another human being. But we don't feel that. Talk to the lady shiur today. How many shiurim do you go to? Not how well do I understand my shiur. I've spent 10 hours revising it inside out and I've now integrated it. Nobody brags about that. Even if anybody would do such a thing, he would keep quiet about it because it would show, I just spent 10 hours on it, I must be pretty dumb. So he keeps quiet. Who brags? The one who says, you know how many shiurim I went to this week? 25 shiurim this week. Ooh, 25 shiurim. What does that mean? You can take a block of wood and also take it to 25 shiurim. Doesn't mean that there's any change at all. In one of the yeshivas I went to, I won't say which one, it used to be said, when I came to the shiur, to the yeshiva, and I asked about a particular boy, and I told him it was in the fifth shiur. I said, ooh, the fifth shiur? It's a Talmid Chochem. They said, no, here it doesn't mean it's a Talmid Chochem if it's in the fifth shiur. Here, if you put a broomstick into the first shiur, 5 years later, it's in the fifth shiur. It doesn't mean anything. The broomstick hasn't changed. You go, you move it. Now, that's not a measure of where you're holding. You can have a young man in the third shiur who's far more outstanding than the young man in the fifth shiur. That was that particular yeshiva system. And so our worth and value has to be measured subjectively and not objectively. This medrash takes that a step further. And sometimes we look at our own bodies as one of the objects as well. We blame our bodies. We split the neshama from the body and we blame our bodies. Why weren't you at the shiur last night? I was tired. It doesn't mean my neshama was tired. My neshama really wanted to come to the shiur. That's what one's really saying. My soul wanted to learn Torah. Of course, I'm a good boy. My body was too tired. Terrible, these bodies, the way they make them nowadays. You know, just not able to stand up to the rigors of modern Torah experience. But tomorrow maybe it will be better. And that's how it is, but it's not. Your body wouldn't be tired if your neshama was operating properly, as we discussed this morning in the ladies' shoe. Everything is integrated. Everything is hooked up and joined together. The one effect the other. You can't isolate, this is my soul and this is my body, and blame everything on the body. And that's why very often we'll take it out on the body. When a person really wants to become very spiritual, very religious, but he hasn't changed, and he really wants to show his spirituality, he does it by taking it out on the body. In Christianity, that's been going on for many centuries. There's no question that many of the people who become priests and nuns do it l'shem shamayim, in their sense. No question about that. Many of them are outstanding, very, very great people. But there are also many, many people who do it as acts of aggression. How many nuns have had disappointments in their romantic life which caused them to give it up? If that's what it's all about, I'll dedicate myself to God. Become a nun. And likewise with the priests. How often is it an admission of failure rather than a taking on of something new from a position of strength? The anorexia, the suicide, that's in a psychological sense, but even in the religious sense, the new chumras that come out that are not based on halacha very often. Chumras based on halacha, we've often distinguished between dikduk halacha and between chumra. If a person wants to be very medakdek in halacha, harezeh meshubach, one has to give him the greatest of credit. If a person wants to take care that he shouldn't come to anything which is possibly wrong, that's 100% in order. On the contrary, that's how a frum Jew should be. But it has to have a basis in halacha. It's got to come from somewhere, not just grabbed out of the air. When these things are grabbed out of the air, one has to be suspicious that you're trying to take it out on the body. You're trying to show how frum you are. Instead of raising the soul, it's like Lashon Hara a little bit, you know. When you're trying to get places and you want to feel progress, there are two ways of doing it. The hard way is to progress. The easier way is to bring everybody else down. And then you can stay where you are and you feel as if you're progressing. I've always said to people who go to California, one of the most important Musa lessons that you can possibly experience is a trip to Universal Studios. That's, I'm sure if the great Bali Musa were alive, I'm sure that's the first trip that they would suggest, even before you start learning Musa, go to Universal Studios. Because there they show you how you can create the illusion of movement while you're absolutely stationary. You just make everything else move and you stay still. And sometimes you ask yourself, but my goodness, isn't it easier just to move one man than to move all this equipment? You must see what they've got there to create the illusion of movement. Man, they explain to you, not so. It's easier to make everything else move than to make one man move properly. All the other things you can control. It's easier to feel progress by pulling everybody else down than it is to really promote yourself and ready to push yourself forward. And that's time and time again what we find ourselves doing. It's convincing ourselves and one another that others are falling back. And therefore we're going forward. And really we're standing exactly where we are. No movement at all. So it is with the body and soul relationship. The one way of moving is to move that soul and to get it going. The other way is to show self-deprivation. And so you show how your body is unimportant to you and how your soul is far further than your body. Not because your soul is elevated, but because you're treating your body so badly. There was a Frum day school overseas that I went into once when I was at yeshiva. And I went into a secular lesson. And Nebuch, the teacher, what they were only doing to this teacher. It was just too terrible. I went to another class, same thing. So I went to the principal afterwards. I said, what's going on? It's supposed to be such a good school, and what this kind of behavior. He said, we employ very bad teachers. I said, that's pretty obvious. I said, where do you find such bad teachers? He said, we pay them very well. We pay them. I said, who would stay under such a... No, he says, we pay them very well. I said, I've never heard of such a thing before. You go looking for bad teachers and you pay them well. If you can pay them well, why don't you take good teachers? He said, the children must know that secular learning is not important. The children must know that secular learning is not important. And I remember scratching my head and thinking, it's going to be interesting now. It can't work, can't be right. All the children can learn from that is that learning isn't important. That's all they can learn from that. And the test will be how they behave in the Limud HaKodesh. I went into the Limud HaKodesh classes where they employed very good teachers, and the children were nearly as wild. It doesn't work. But there you have a system of, again, without trying to, we want to show them what he really meant to say is we want to show them that Torah is far more important than anything secular. There's no comparison. That what you can learn in Torah is more wonderful, more exhilarating, more stimulating, broader, deeper, bigger. That's what you want to show them. But he fell into the trap. I'm not prepared to do it by means of fine Torah teaching. So that they'll see that no matter how good the secular teaching is, the Torah is just far superb. No, the way to do it is by demoting the secular. You can leave the Torah then mediocre, it doesn't matter. Then even mediocre Torah will look good. That's the illusions we create for ourselves. And in the body-soul relationship, we do it at the same time. Let's smash the body, let's hit the body, let's talk it down. It's a nothing, it's a gondit, it's a useless, we don't like it, we don't need it, let's treat it badly, and that will make us feel spiritually good. That's the danger of compulsive religion, any religion, including Yiddishkeit, and that is the danger of the nausea. And this one has to watch very carefully, by the way, because it is so prevalent, and one sees usually it's in the same people. The same people who collect the pages of Gemara are the people who collect Shiurim and who collect Chumras and who emphasize their spirituality by de-emphasizing physical and secular things. And one has to be very, very alert to it. That's the one kind of nozer, and for that reason, says Shimon HaTzadik, I didn't partake of the Nazirus, because what usually happens with such a person, he's also got a healthy Yetzirah. Don't think that these are angels, these nuns and priests, whether Jewish or non-Jewish, I'm using the term in terms of that kind of self-deprivation. Don't think they don't have Yetzirahs. Don't think they're a bunch of angels that have completely transcended any kind of other interests. They have Yetzirahs, and how they have Yetzirahs. And if a Yetzirah isn't correctly channeled, it breaks out wild and destructive. So Shimon HaTzadik, when this nozir, after one day of it, 2 days of it, a week of it, 2 weeks of it, he starts getting annoyed with himself. He shouldn't have done it. He wants the opportunity, the freedom to still have a glass of wine if he wants to. And that regret invalidates the korban. And in a sense, not halachically, but certainly spiritually, and therefore Shimon HaTzadik took the view that he would rather have nothing to do with those korbanos. What about this nozir from the south? This nozir from the south is a different story altogether. He, says Shimon HaTzadik, says the Medrash, mitoch yishuv hadas nodor ufiv v'libo sholim. Shovim. He took his oath with clear mind, and his heart and his mind were, and his mind and his mouth were parallel. How do we know? Maybe he also was an angry young man who took over the neder, saw himself in the water and took this neder. The interesting thing about the hair cutting is its delayed effect. It's true, on the one hand, one is not having a haircut for a month. It's one source of tzar. But what the Medrash, what Shimon HaTzadik is more worried about in this case, with the nozir, with his long curly hair, is that he's now going to have to shave it off. That shaving off takes place 30 days after the original neder, which is a very good way to check whether one is reacting or whether one is acting. Well, a very good thing to do is to tell the person to come back later. It's time. I have certain people that I know already that contact me with a great emergency. They've got to see me immediately. So the different ways of sorting that out, I'm giving you the secrets now. The one way is to say, right, I have time at 2 o'clock tomorrow morning. And sometimes the urgency just disappears. It's not that urgent. You know? Can wait till tomorrow. I say, tomorrow I haven't got time, so then I can wait till the next day. I said, for a week I haven't got time. Good, he says, I can wait for a week. So all of a sudden it's not so urgent. That's the one way. Then the other customers that I know, it won't help. If I say at 2 o'clock, come at 2 o'clock in the morning, they'll be there at 2 o'clock in the morning, because at the moment it really is urgent. But nevertheless, it's a good idea that there's no point in discussing it when it's in that state of hyped up tension. Come in a week's time. That's the time to do it. The Torah says, when did he cut his hair? The self-deprivation of hair cutting is in a month's time. The denial of wine is immediate. The moment he undertakes the neder, the wine he must stop drinking immediately. But he's only going to shave off his beautiful curls in 30 days' time. This nozir was motivated not by the wine. He was motivated by the hair. Now we found in the Gemara that I learned with you already in Tainis, that Rabbi Elazar Hekper learns that a nozir is a sinner from his deprivation of wine. And Rabbi Elazar learns that he is a kodesh from his relationship with his hair, from his willingness to deprive himself of good hairstyling, whether during the 30 days or after the 30 days. Let's, for the sake of this medrash, talk about after the 30 days, the fact that he's going to shave off his hair. Therefore, there we see kedusha. Why in the one do we see kedusha and in the other we see sin? Why in the self-denial of wine do we see, for that you've got to bring a korban, and in the self-denial of being willing to shave off your hair, we see in that kedusha? The answer is simply a time element. The wine, that's immediate. A person in a moment of anger can undertake a neder, which is where he's going to deny himself wine, and to deny himself the pleasures of man. The hair cutting. He's now undertaking a neder that in 30 days' time he's going to shave his hair. That can't be used for immediate aggression. When you're angry and frustrated and aggressive, you don't make undertakings now that in 30 days' time that's what I'm going to do. It's right now it has to be done. There isn't a moment to wait. That's the pitfall of anger. One does things on the spur of the moment which one is inevitably going to regret later on. Even if one would do the thing after one cools down, one wouldn't do it in the same way. There's inevitably a different attitude after one's been able to think the matter over and sort it out. And so the Gemara learns out of his willingness to shave his hair, a kedusha, there's a sanctity. Out of his self-deprivation of the wine, you see self-denial. So Shimon HaTzadik, when I realized that this young man was motivated in his nazirus by the desire to shave his hair, he wasn't motivated by a desire not to drink the wine. He was motivated by a desire to cut off his hair. That was a delayed action motivation. He realized that he's going to have to wait 30 days before he does it. Then he realizes that this is not a man who does it in a moment of impulsive anger. But there's more to it than that. Look at the words that the young man uses. He says, "Omarti loy, I said to my Yetzihora, Rosho, you wicked fellow, ma'ato misnare bedovashin shelcho. What are you taking pleasure in something which is not yours? Shel ofo, shel rima, shel toleahu. This is dust, it's decay and it's worms. Olayla hagdishcho lo shamayim, ulegalechecho lo shamayim. I am going to dedicate you to heaven and shave you for heaven." What does he mean? Why did you say, "I'm going to become a nozer and shave this wicked hair off"? That would have been also an act of aggression. He doesn't say that. He says it's going to go through two stages. My first stage is going to be to dedicate my hair to the Ribbono Shel Olam by becoming a nozir. And therefore I will shave it off. Why? What he's doing here is not self-deprivation at all. He's simply disassociating a sense of ownership between his hair and himself. It's not mine. Once it's not mine, it's not deprivation to cut it off. It wasn't mine to start with. And here we have the Jewish approach to precious, to self-deprivation. Yes, there is such a very positive channels. This type of environment that I referred to earlier on, where everything we see in the object, our success is measured in the object, our problems are measured in the object, everything is seen in the object. I gave a lecture recently explaining why that all developed over the last 40 years. But in brief, there's a very close correlation between that attitude, which is now worldwide, in the Western world anyway, probably the East too now, and the extent to which parents after the war tried to give their children things was the first time, firstly, that they could afford to do it on a very wide scale, where even ordinary people had money. There was great, not wealth, but there was a certain affluence in the 1950s and the early 1960s. There was money around, particularly in America, all over the world. But the rebuilding after the war brought full employment, and there was money, and there wasn't inflation yet. From an economic point of view, they were wonderful times. People thought those times would never end. So firstly, families could afford. A kid wants a television, buy a television. Whatever they wanted. Surveys have been done showing that young American families today are far worse off economically than their parents were. The average American family. There hasn't been an increase in standard of living. There's been a decrease in standard of living. A very marked decrease in standard of living. Very much fewer Americans own their own homes. Time magazine gave some figures of the number of 40-year-olds earning under $10,000 a year. My father, a very, very small percentage that were earning $30,000 and over. And anybody who's been to America knows that with $30,000 you can still hardly live. How one lives on $12,000 in America, I have no idea. And certainly for a Jew, certainly you can't live on $30,000. Might pay your school fees for one or two kids. Maybe you'll have a little bit left over for part of the rent. But that's about all. But even for a non-Jewish family that can live in places where a frum family can't live, that doesn't have to pay for education, $12,000 is poverty. And these young people, these are university graduates. These are not people from the slums. People with MAs, MSCs, PhDs, and they talk about their anger at having been misled. They were told, you know, you'll go to university and you'll get education. Your parents didn't have education, and look how well they did. Can you imagine what you'll do with education? And they went and spent all that money and time on education, and they're nowhere near their parents' level of economic affluence. So that was a very affluent time, in a sense, the 1950s and the 1960s. And parents could give their children things. In addition to that, there had been a loss of faith. It was a very anti-religious period of time. been a complete loss of faith. Don't forget that not only had there just been a terrible world war, which had been won at great cost, but there was also the beginning of the nuclear age, where there was the fear of world destruction. So something, nobody knew what this bomb could do, and when it was dropped, it shattered the world's belief in its future. The world did not believe that there would be, if you tell people then that in 40 years' time we would still be around, they would look at you very cynically, not very likely. And once the Russians got the bomb as well, then rather that we wouldn't be around for long. It was a terrible feeling of pessimism that there isn't much more, so you might as well have what you can get and get hold of things, physical things that you can touch, that you can feel. There was a loss of belief in spiritual values and in things that had to be developed over long periods of time. Be that as it may, that acquisitive attitude had a great deal to do with the approach of pinning all one's hopes and all one's problems on objects outside of oneself, on things that are outside of oneself. This Nozir comes along and he says, I'm not entitled to it. It's not mine. That's the way he handles the Yetzirah. Looks in the reflection, sees the beauty, for a moment thinks of what he could do in the discotheques of Tel Aviv, and responds not by saying, you dirty so-and-so, just take out your Mesilas Yesharim and start living. That's not what he does. Doesn't think such things. Evil thoughts. He realizes that's not going to work. He realizes more that you can't blame the Yetzirah as something outside of you. That's also something we tend to do. It's also Christian theology. A devil outside, he's making me get up to all this mischief. No, he realizes my attitudes have to change. There has to be a reorientation. A whole new philosophy has to be built. It's my views, it's my attitudes which are causing the problem. My attitudes, not something outside me. I'm thinking wrong. My value system is cockeyed. What needs to change? Less of a sense of entitlement. There's beautiful curls. They're not mine. It's a shetel. You can take it off and drop it in the water. Not a real shetel, but it's like a shetel because you can snip it off. And if you don't snip it off, in any case, it's going to be decay and become all wormy eventually afterwards. It's temporary. And just as a woman would not stand in front of a mirror and admire, she might admire her shetel, but she doesn't admire herself. That's the difference. And a married woman, when a woman looks in the mirror and looks at her hairstyle after she comes out of the hairdresser, she says, how beautiful I look, which she's fully entitled to say and to think. When she's wearing a shetel, she doesn't. She says, ah, what a nice shetel I got. She might be beautiful as well, but that she sees in other areas, not from the hair. It's a completely different relationship. This Nozir relates to his hair like a shetel, something which can be taken on and off, and which in fact, not only is the shetel, he says to himself, it's a borrowed shetel, it's not even mine, it belongs to somebody else. I've just got it for a while. And he takes his assets, in this case his beauty and his hair, and his makdish to the Ribbono Shel Olam. This belongs to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Now when the Ribbono Shel Olam says, what I want is for you to cut it off, that's easy. If you've borrowed somebody else's shetel and the balabost of the shetel comes along and says, you know, do me a favor, stick it in the washing machine. So I wouldn't do that to such a beautiful shetel. If that's what you want, stick it in the washing machine. It doesn't bother you, it's not yours. Once the object is not yours, you'll do whatever the balabost tells you to do with it. You don't feel attached to it. This Nozir has detached himself from that asset which made him feel so special and so great. And he realized, I don't want to feel unique because of possessions I have, and he regards his hair as a possession. The possessions aren't mine, I'm makdish that to the Ribbono Shel Olam. I want to feel special and unique from the actions I do, from the changes that come over me, from the value system I have, from the person I am, and from the feelings I have. Not from the thing on my head, that's not where I want to achieve my sense of specialness.